It's been really interesting listening to all the other papers today, particularly having been at some of the earliest analyses, because I think the ways that the literature has been used and some of the themes that have emerged are quite different to the ones that we've had so far. So it's quite nice to see that even 4 seminars in, we're still generating new ideas and new perspectives. That's quite encouraging. I've also, all through the day, been frantically scribbling on my own draft paper because I had something to say about pretty much every other paper that was presented, in good ways or bad ways, or to kind of touch upon issues that other people have dealt with. I think one of the main ones, and one of the main ways that my paper will hopefully add to what we've heard today, is that, at least for the second half, it's a country case study. It's looking particularly at post-genocide Rwanda and a specific alignment decision that it made in 2008-2009, which I argue was an attempt to maximise its agency, in spite of what people might consider the fact that Rwanda was a weak state, some very aid dependent, etc. I'm hoping that by bringing a country like Rwanda into the mix, we can start to challenge some of these sometimes very sweeping discourses about state weakness. I think some African states and some African leaders, David, I'm really sorry, I'm not going to clarify how I talk about agency or state agency or leader agency, because I think we'll be here for the rest of the day, actually have quite a lot of power in the international system. I think they have quite a lot of influence on the way that donors think about successful developmental states, on the way that donors think about African security and the relationship between African security and international security. So the paper in a lot of ways is quite wide-ranging, but I am hoping that it'll be something of a rejoinder, or at least a talking point, in contrast to some of the other papers that we've had. In terms of other aspects that I'm going to end up picking up on, I've got points here about the African peer review mechanism. It's a very small point, but I will make it as well. I've got something about coalition government. I've got something about BIOD. I did make mention about your paper in somewhere. So I think overall we're going to touch on quite a few different areas. All right, so there's two main purposes to the paper, and I'm not sure that it necessarily does both of them equally well. It's trying to do two different things, but one half of it is about talking about ways that Rwanda maximises its agency, particularly through the strategy of alignment. The second aspect of it is about IR theory, and particularly this quite dated theory of omnibalancing, which is around the very end of the Cold War, which I'm going to talk about again today. And I'm trying to bring it back. I'm not sure that there are enough examples of where this has happened to actually bring it back as a valid theory. But I think it does offer us some interesting ways of analysing foreign policy of what we can sometimes term to be weak African states or aid-dependent African states that we might not otherwise have considered. So those are the two main purposes of the paper. So the first thing I'm going to do is to explain what omnibalancing is, for those of you who don't know. And I wouldn't say for those of you who aren't old enough to remember, because obviously I was tiny, even tinier. When I was balancing. I think I was 9. When only balancing was the article this is based on was first published. So I'll go through the basics of that. And then I want to talk about a couple of the ways that I think it needs to be revised or updated in order to be useful to us in analysing African strategies for maximizing agency, because it's very much a product of the time that it was written in the Cold War context. And then what I want to try and do is to apply it to Rwanda's alignment with the Democratic Republic of Congo, which I'll call Congo throughout, and some people are very fussy about this, but I'm just going to say Congo because it's easier. And then finally, hopefully make some broader points about African agency, based on what we've heard today, previous seminars, and my example. So that's the strategy. Okay. It might not take 40 minutes, it just depends how fast I get. Right, so omnibalancing. In the paper, I go through the reasons that David comes up with this theory of omnibalancing, and it's partly because he rejects the realist and near-realist approaches to explaining what he calls third world alignment. Now, I have issues with the concept of third world, and I will talk about that a little bit more in a few minutes. But this is basically where he's coming from. He's trying to explain why leaders in third world states align with one or the other of the two main superpower blocks during the Cold War. So what strategies are they trying to pursue by making those alliances, by aligning their policies with those states? he argues that it's not possible to use a realist or a neorealist approach because they rely on this distinction between anarchy at the international level and order at the national level. And David's basic argument is that in a lot of third world states, he argues in all third world states, because they are internally similar enough that you can call them one category, there is a lack of order, and therefore you can't juxtapose international anarchy and national order, because there's actually anarchy at both levels. Again, there are problems with that, but I'm going to skip over them, having seen the discussion this morning about realism and neorealism, and not being probably as up on my IR theory as I should be, so I'll leave that to one side for now. But he argues basically that he's going beyond realism and neorealism to explain why alignment occurs. Because his balance of power theory relies on the distinction between national order and international anarchy, but third world states lack an internal order. He also argues that the primary focus should therefore be not on threats to states, but on threats to leaders, because the situation of internal anarchy or internal disorder within third world states means that the main threat is not actually to the survival of the state necessarily, but to the survival of a leadership or an elite. So he focuses on what decisions does that leadership take, in order to maximise its power and also to maintain its own survival. Because at the time that he was writing and looking back on a Cold War context, military coups were quite prevalent, and also armed rebellion is quite prevalent. So you're not necessarily just talking about survival in the sense of whether a government will continue to replicate itself and to exist, but whether individuals and heads of state will continue to exist in the mortal sense. So he's interested in regimes and leaders. He argues, therefore, that the most powerful determinant of third world alignment behaviour is the rational calculation of third world leaders as to which outside power is most likely to do what is necessary to keep them in power. And I think in a lot of ways that sort of reflects the kind of work that Bayard has done, the kind of work that Reno has done as well, William Reno, on some African states. But he's basically arguing that when leaders make decisions about which side of the Cold War they're going to align with, they make that decision based on their own safety and their own security and who's likely to protect them. This is also based on the argument that third world leaders are therefore inherently weak and illegitimate. So leaders in these states have no other way necessarily of maintaining their own rule except through external support, primarily through military support, also through aid, with which to counter domestic opposition. So the main threats to a state, the state's leadership, are domestic ones. He also argues that leaders will then appease or align with secondary threats to allow themselves to focus their efforts on dealing with primary threats. So there's a calculation going on as to who is the greater threat to the survival of a state leadership. And this may mean that they will align with an organisation, or they will align with a particular constellation of power, whether it's a superpower, because they feel that that is going to allow them the space to deal with an internal threat, which they think of as being a primary threat to their survival. Just about playing off power at different levels, essentially. He also argues that they may act in ways that protect their own security at the expense of the best interests of the state. And again, I think this is something that we've seen in the African studies literature, and this isn't something that's particularly new, but we need to dwell on at the moment. So that's his basic argument. Now, I have a couple of problems with it, not least that it's based in the Cold War bipolar system, and obviously we no longer exist in that system, and the strategies that African states and African leaders have pursued to maximise their agency in the international system aren't crafted with reference to that bipolar world order. They're crafted in response to a series of other narratives and other pressures, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a minute. He also argues that the category of the third world is similar enough, and there is enough similarity between and across states to be able to generalise. So for him, states when we're talking about North Africa and the differences between North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, and why those are considered to be completely different spheres of action. He didn't see them as completely different spheres of action in areas, or the Middle East for that matter. The examples that he uses to back up his case are from Egypt and Ethiopia during the Cold War, so Sub-Saharan and North Africa. But actually, if we look at the ways that his work has been used by others, and there's some examples of this in the paper, it's mainly been used by theorists working on Middle Eastern studies, particularly people like Gerd Mommermann, Ray Hinnebusch, working on Kurdish movement, working on Syria, and also on Saudi Arabia. So a variety of states, primarily in the Middle East, and nobody's ever really taken this up and used it in relation to sub-Saharan Africa, except for David, and he was doing it in a Cold War context. So this is the element of bringing omnibalancing back. I'm not sure whether it's possible to bring it back, or whether it's necessarily useful to bring it back, but we're going to have a go anyway, and we'll see. Because it is one of the few theoretical tools that we have that looks at explaining agency in this sort of way through alignment, sort of looks at how leaders of states make decisions about how they align themselves in order to maximise their ability to act, counter challenges and pressures. So I think the core of it is useful because it encourages us to focus on ruling regimes and elites, and I think elites in Africa are still incredibly important. And I'm talking about elites at the state level, but I do recognise that there are many other constellations and formations of power which are transnational, and we could also potentially look at those, but that's not what I'm doing today. And also I think it's useful because it gives us this emphasis on balancing of external and internal threats in order to maximise the ability to counter different challenges. So in terms of how I would update it and how I try to update this theory in the paper, to take it beyond the bipolar world, I basically argue that you have to bring in other dominant and powerful narratives that are used by and in some ways used against and used to control or to try and shape policies of African states. So particularly democratisation during the 1990s and beyond, the pressure for states to become more accountable, more responsive to their populations, and at least in terms of rhetoric of donor countries, that's continued to exist. So I think democratisation is one of the big narratives that's come to dominate Africa's global relationships. A second is African solutions to African problems. In terms of sequence, I'm not necessarily sure that this comes after democratisation, because I think it's something that goes right from the early 90s all the way through. This argument that African organisations, and we talk about the sort of golden decade, there's a lot of discussion about African renaissance and particular leaders and particular ideas that could provide homegrown solutions for the challenges that Africa faced and faces, particularly in terms of conflict, recognition that Western states were not going to be, and I don't know why you would expect Western states to necessarily provide troops for African conflicts, because they don't provide that many troops for other conflicts, and they certainly didn't during this period either. But this emphasis on African states providing military solutions and also ideational solutions and thinking on their own problems. And thirdly, and some dispute this, but I believe that the global war on terror and the emphasis on terrorism and the argument that underdevelopment is dangerous, destabilising and has spillover effects on the rest of the world has had quite a profound shaping effect on the way that donor states and the way the international community more generally relates to developing states and regions. So the way that the UK relates to African states, if you look at the Building Stability Overseas Strategy, this FCO-MOD, DFID, and most recent joined-up strategy, it's about bringing development, security and foreign policy together in particular ways. And I can talk more about UK policy if people are interested in that. But I think the global war on terror, focus on democracy and on African solutions to African problems all take us way beyond the kind of arena that David was talking about when he was just talking about a bipolar world order and a very quite simple black and white distinction. Secondly, I don't think I even necessarily need to say this in a room full of people who work on or whoever lived in any African state, but I don't think you can homogenise this category of third world. I don't think it's even necessarily useful to say sub-Saharan Africa as a unit or a category of analysis and for the purposes of what I'm doing. And I think that's also shown by the fact that nobody has tried to apply his work to sub-Saharan Africa as a whole category. In the paper, I suggest that that what I'm doing isn't only applicable to Rwanda, but might also have relevance for other states that are ruled by former rebel groups. So, and for reasons that will become apparent, by basically limiting my analysis to a much smaller group of countries. I think you also need to consider, in a way that David doesn't in his analysis, what kinds of threats leaders are facing. I mean, he's talking about that very visceral, mortal threat to survival of leaders. But actually, threats nowadays don't just come in the form of coups and armed insurrections. And in some ways, that's perhaps less likely than it was during the Cold War. Obviously, no events in North Africa are completely undermining my argument, but that's fine, we're just going to ignore that. We're talking mainly about sub-Saharan Africa for now, and we'll go back to that if people want to. But for the purposes of my argument, because democratisation and democracy promotion has become such a big part of international relations with Africa and with African states, I think democratisation, because of the way that elections provide a regularised, predictable flashpoint for dissent and for opposition forces to gather to particular governments, provide more of a threat than armed coup, insurrection, etc. And in the paper, I go into sort of, to some detail on what this means. I talk a little bit about, I can say something about the, I'll leave it to one side for now, but, I was going to try and find something, but it's fine, I'll leave it, it'll come back to me. Basically, I make an argument about third termism and also the move to coalition governments, both as responses to this threat. So the argument that the international community has no appetite for civil war in Africa, obviously, and therefore favours negotiated solutions, and that means that oppositions have much less incentive to accept defeat, and incumbent governments also have much less incentive to accept electoral defeat. Oh, you found it. There we go. Thank you. That's very good of you. All right, great. So you were ahead of my argument, and I was lost somewhere in the middle. Okay. Yeah. So basically, saying third termism, where leaders seek to change constitutions to extend their term in power, and coalition governments, where leaders of opposition and government refuse to accept electoral defeat, buoyed by the knowledge that elections are rarely substantially free and fair, and the preference of the international community for non-violent resolution favours compromise. That's basically what I just said. But thank you. Okay, so democratisation and the regularised flashpoint of elections provides a potential focus for dissent against ruling elites, and that can be considered more of a threat in this contemporary circumstances. I also think that in David's analysis, he too easily separates the international from the national. Basically argues there are two spheres where we should be considering African policy or third world policy in his analysis, and that's policy at state level and policy at the international level. And I think for sub-Saharan Africa in particular, not uniquely, the region is a really important area. And foreign policies of African states, and I was discussing this with Ralph just during the break a little while ago, are often more directed at immediate region and immediate neighbours and the continent and the subcontinent than they are internationally. And that's partly because that's a stage where African states have potentially more agency, more ability to operate. Tools that they have at their disposal vary, whether it's military, economic, etc. But I can talk again about that in a little while if people are interested. So I think the region is important, not only because it provides an area of opportunity for African states to act, but also in terms of sources of threat. If you are still considering military threats to African states and security threats, then actually the region is of much more concern, I would argue, than the international stage. So when you're talking about policies of African states and leaders, the national, the regional and the international, I think, is at least as far as it should be broken down. But obviously there are a lot of relationships between those three levels as well. And finally, this argument that David makes that African states, that third world states, but I'm narrowing it to African, sub-Saharan African states, have weak leaders and regimes. Now I would argue that, particularly in the context of the war on terror, as I've discussed and mentioned briefly earlier, that vulnerability is not necessarily something that just proves a weakness or makes African states weak. I think vulnerability in some ways can be a resource, because if you are a leader of a state which donors consider to be potentially unstable or potentially destabilizing for the rest of the region, and you can present yourself as a bulwark against that threat of instability, then actually your vulnerability becomes part of your arsenal, it becomes part of your discussions with donors. And I think some of that emerged from my reading of Graham Harrison's on governing states as well, and sovereign frontier and the area in which negotiations take place between states and, well, between African states and donors and other actors as well. And I think this argument that vulnerability and weakness are necessarily bad things and necessarily mean that African states and African leaders occupy a relegated, marginal position in world politics is I'm trying to find a nice way of saying wrong. is incomplete. Incomplete. Too simplistic. There you go. Too simplistic. And I also think that despite weakness of so many African states, not all African states fall into that category. And particularly my own work on Rwanda always means that I come to those discussions with a degree of skepticism. For a small state, very high population density, the Rwandan government has control over everything, and I'm not going to caveat that. Pretty much everything that happens within its borders has very strong control over economy, society, politics. So this notion that African states, all African states, are necessarily weak and lack control domestically is problematic. We can argue about whether Rwanda is an exception and the only exception, but I'll leave that to one side for now. Okay, so that's sort of omnibalancing and what I try to do to omnibalancing and in the context of the paper. How long have I got?
You've got about 20 minutes.
All right, well that's fine, because I'm on the second half. So So I take Sophie's point earlier about, you know, we're all sort of Africanists to some degree around the table, and people will hopefully have a background in terms of the Rwandan genocide and the impact of that on Rwanda's politics. So I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail, but I will give a couple of points about Rwanda's politics at the domestic, regional and international level, just so that then when I introduce my arguments about omnibalancing, it's clear where the threats come in and where the opportunities are as well at those three different levels. So obviously the experience of the genocide is quite a significant influence on the domestic and foreign policy of Rwanda, but as Ralph reminded me when we were talking earlier, even prior to the genocide, Rwanda was seen as something of a good performer in terms of development, had strong relationships with France, and actually had quite a lot of agency in its dealings with international actors compared to other sub-Saharan African states. So I won't fall into the trap of assuming that Rwanda only exists from 1994 onwards, because obviously it doesn't. And that's a caveat, and now I'm going to go on to pretend that it doesn't exist from until 1994, just for the purposes of this, because my focus is on this RPF-led regime in Kigali, and that's basically where it takes over. So the genocide is ended not by the UN force, which is based in Rwanda at the time, but by the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which is a primarily exile army, primarily made up, but not completely, of Tutsi Rwandan refugees living in Uganda, Tanzania, and elsewhere. So all you really need to know about that is a refugee army comes back, ends the genocide, and has this very strong sense of moral authority and fear of future genocide. So since 1994, the RPF has dominated Rwandan politics. Between 1994 and 2003, Rwanda was run by a national unity government, which was led by a Hutu RPF member. A pastor with Kagame, who's now leader of Rwanda as vice president. Kagame took over as president in 2000 when Bizimunguru resigned, and Bizimunguru was later arrested for threatening state security for arguing that the regime had become too intolerant of dissent. He was also arrested on weapons charges and a number of other charges as well. So it wasn't just an easily identifiable political reason for arresting and incarcerating Bizimunguru. But basically, over the period from 1994 to 2003, the RPF consolidates its role within Rwanda and promotes a very consensus-based approach to politics, arguing that the most important thing for Rwanda's future is national unity. Because there is very little leadership in Rwanda at this time, which is not tied in with and to the RPF elite and regime, that basically means that a national unity policy is support for an RPF rule, and I can discuss that if more people are interested. Okay, so in 2003 you have the first parliamentary elections, and an RPF-led coalition of parties takes 75% of the vote, roughly. And the presidential election that year, Kagame wins 95% of the vote. They did a survey, I can't remember the name of the survey, but it'll come back to me, and I'll put it in the cited version of the paper, which I'll send to you to go back on the internet. They did a survey looking at approval ratings for presidents and parliaments, and the only other country that gets anywhere near the levels of approval ratings as Kagame and the RPF is China. So there's not, you know, there isn't really anywhere else that you have these kind of really, really high levels. And there's different ways of reading that. You could argue that it's because people are scared to vote for anyone else. You could also argue that no one else has been able to or has articulated an alternative vision. You could also argue that people are so scared by what happened in 94 that they're not really interested in politics. Democratic multi-party politics was not a good experience for Rwandans, and actually they just want to be left alone to get on with their lives and do other things, develop themselves and their children and all the rest of it. So there's different ways of reading that. But what we can say, take away from it is there is a very dominant position for the RPF in Rwandan politics. I don't think anybody can really argue with that. We had more recent elections in 2008, and the RPF led through an increased share of the vote to almost 80%. So that trend has continued. So domestically, the main narratives of the RPF have been never again in terms of the possible return of the genocide. So, you know, we secured Rwanda, we ended the genocide, we'll make sure it doesn't happen again. And that's underpinned by quite impressive achievements in levels of public security. Rwanda is an incredibly safe place to, as a tourist, as a researcher. It's a strange country in the sense that when you tell people that you do research in Rwanda, they go, oof. You go, no, it's fine, actually. It's a really safe place to do research. You don't want to upset the government too many times, because I think after that you just don't get to go anymore. It seems to be what happens. But you know, it's a relatively safe place to work. And it impresses donors in terms of levels of development, levels of security, and just really basic things like how clean Kigali is and how well organized and all the rest of it. Lack of corruption, etc. Okay, so never again. A focus on national unity underpinned by Rwandanness, which is the only identity basically in Rwanda now. It's basically getting rid of the old ethnic identities on which the genocide was based. And also, the government has passed legislation against what they call genocide ideology, and there's been a lot of criticism of that by international human rights groups in particular, arguing that it's so vaguely defined that it means that anybody who disagrees with any government policy can be accused of harbouring genocide ideology or being revisionist, and that that's being used to persecute opponents. And there are sort of arguments on both sides of that. And again, I can talk about it during questions if people want me to. There's very little tolerance of dissent. I think it's fair to say there's a really narrow political space in Rwanda, and it's probably narrowed since 94. It's kind of gotten narrower and narrower. But then you get to a point where people understand the rules of the game, and they don't even sort of gather in ways that are threatening to the government, or act or express opinions in ways that could be seen as threatening to the government. So the Rwandan government doesn't have sort of a strategy of events in the UK would seem to correct this recently with that discussion about whether they'd sent a hitman to the UK to target opposition activists. The Rwandan government does not kill dozens and dozens of activists. It's not going out there and assassinating dozens of politicians in a very high-profile way. The fact that people believe that what's happened in Rwanda is a targeted campaign and a quiet campaign, which is either orchestrated by the government or by people who support the government, means that it stopped people from acting in particular ways. It basically stopped people from trying to put forward alternative views, from trying to oppose the Rwandan government. So whether or not it's possible to prove that the Rwandan government is behind the tightening of political space in terms of attacks on opposition and critics, it still has an impact on the ways people behave. So it's kind of neither here nor there in that sense. So domestically, very little political space. The Rwandan government, and the RPF in particular, argues that it is the only party that can keep Rwandans safe, and it has quite a good record in terms of development. In terms of the region, Rwanda has had quite rocky ties with Uganda. Quite strong personal ties for individuals with Uganda, because a lot of the high-level RPF were raised, possibly some born, in Uganda and still maintain ties. But the Ugandan President Museveni has always discussed the RPF as being his boys and has been quite sort of derogatory and dismissive of the RPF, and that's caused friction between the two. The more important relationship for the purposes of the paper is the relationship between Rwanda and Congo. After the genocide, people will know about this, but you had fleeing of people who committed the genocide along with an awful lot of Hutu refugees, from hundreds of thousands, into eastern Congo. Rwanda invades twice between 1996 and 2003 and deposes Christ of a Boot, so I think I'm speaking about things that people are familiar with, so I won't have to go into any details yet. But basically the point that we need to take from this is that there is an ongoing potential security threat to the Rwandan government in eastern Congo through the remnants of this genocidal army. We're talking less than 10,000 now, and it's very hard to get accurate figures on. Maybe Tom has some accurate figures he can give us during the... He possibly does. Okay. It's a shame that Knox spoke, because I'm fairly sure that he would have some accurate figures. He knows about these things. So it's a quite small force, but still a threat to the Rwandan government. And also, in terms of the reverse relationship, the Congolese government is incredibly wary of Rwanda because this country has mounted an armed invasion twice and succeeded in deposing the president and roamed at will throughout huge trenches of Congolese territory. So there's animosity and strained relations on both sides. In terms of internationally, I was going to say something about the APRM just very briefly. So in terms of Rwanda's relationships within the region, it's also very keen to be a player on the regional stage. It was one of the first to undergo the APRM. It did relatively well. There were some problems that were highlighted on the political development side, which again I can say more about if people are interested. But Rwanda values African institutions, and it does seem to put quite a lot of stock into them. And you can see that with the East African community. And the African Development Bank, president of which I think is still a Rwandan, the Rwandan contribution to peacekeeping forces in Darfur, etc. So there's very much a stage that Rwanda wants to be known on. In terms of internationally, after the genocide, Rwanda expressed a preference for Anglophone and Scandinavian donors over France and Belgium, basically, partly because of the operations of those two countries in the run-up to, during colonialism and then during the genocide. And again, I can talk about that in questions if people don't know about that already. The RPF have been very clever in terms of the way they've courted donors, in terms of the way they've presented themselves, the way that they've been amenable to particular kinds of reform. In some ways, I think they're very similar to Harrison's other governance states, and I think a lot of the other characteristics also fit. So I'm not sure why Rwanda isn't in there. But it seems being a developmental state, and there's some literature on this, which has emerged recently. I'm talking about Rwanda as a developmental patrimonial state, which again I can talk about if people are interested in that during questions. So it's one reputation basically is development-minded, determined, with a strong military and a stable, if tightly managed, political system. Seen as a strong partner in African security because of its contribution to Darfur and to peacekeeping in Darfur, which took it into the top 10 of UN peacekeeping contributing nations, which is quite impressive considering the rest of the countries in that list are places like Bangladesh, Pakistan, countries with huge militaries. Rwanda is very, very small by comparison. So these are obviously areas where it wants to be seen as a partner. But also at the international level, in terms of its relationships with donors, Rwanda is very aid dependent, and Kagame has made a lot of comments about wanting to get out of aid dependency, to become self-sufficient, to look for alternative donors. But as it stands, the UK is still quite a significant donor to Rwanda. I think it's still the largest bilateral. So there's a number of potential threats to the Rwandan regime at different levels. At the national level, you've got the threat of civil society and opposition, which is actually proven quite good at dealing with historically, and it tends to be able to deal with those threats without generating an awful lot of international response or international censure. In the regional level, you have the relationship with Congo, and again, it's been given a relatively free hand. I mean, there's been a lot of media coverage of Rwanda's role in Central Africa and in the Congo wars, even since the official withdrawal of its troops. But there hasn't been a great deal of actual censure. The Netherlands and Sweden have withdrawn aid. Canada dropped Rwanda as a bilateral partner, but the UK continues its relationship. Most of my work has been focused on the UK. And then in terms of internationally, it has this strong relationship with donors, but it is in a relationship of dependency. So, omnibalancing and Rwanda's search for agency. And it's quite a brief example, so hopefully I'll get through it quite quickly. So the whole purpose of this paper for me was trying to explain why Rwanda aligned with the DRC in 2009. It seemed to go against everything that would be expected. Rwanda and the DRC had this incredibly antagonistic relationship. Rwanda was free to operate with relative impunity in Congo, in eastern Congo, and with relationship to eastern Congo. And then suddenly it decided that it would arrest a proxy rebel leader was operating in Western Congo on Congo's behalf, ostensibly, and that it would enter into joint military exercises with the country, which is something that it had been refusing to do. And this all seemed very confusing until you looked at it through the lens of army balancing. So this rebel leader, Laurent Nkunda, had been affiliated previously with a Rwandan-backed rebel group in Congo and had joined the new Congolese armed forces when this was created after the sort of peace accords and then the run up to the elections in Congo. He basically broke away from the Congolese army, attacked Goma, attacked UN peacekeepers in eastern Congo, and threatened to try and topple the Kabila regime in Congo. Now what this meant is that people had already been saying that Nkunda and the Rwandan government and leadership had quite strong links, in that Nkunda would apparently maintain Rwanda's business interests, reef mineral interests in Congo, and protection for those, in return for being allowed to come into Rwanda and to recruit from refugee camps. Now it's quite, there's actually relatively limited evidence from what I've seen in terms of publicly available evidence at least, of that relationship. But that's how the Congolese government saw this anyway. So they were already annoyed at Rwanda about this. Rwanda also, at this point, faces quite a significant challenge, because once Nkunda threatens the Congolese government can't afford to just ignore what's going on in the east any longer, or sort of say, well, we can't do anything about it, because actually a threat from a rebel group leader to topple a Congolese president with Rwandan backing is not all that empty and hollow a threat. It's something that has happened before. It may well be unlikely that the army and Rwanda would ever agree to do that, but it was a credible potential threat as far as the Congolese government was concerned. So Congo had to raise the stakes in its rhetoric and to start threatening Rwanda, or at least being more aggressive in terms of its dealings with Rwanda. Rwanda also had to decide how it was going to deal with this rebel leader who suddenly gotten a bit too big for his boots and was trying to carve out his own place when the Rwandan government didn't particularly want him to. In terms of how this plays internationally and locally, at the same time you have the elections in 2008 in Rwanda. This is all happening in late 2008. There have been a lot of criticism about the lack of political space during those 2008 elections, and civil society trying to agitate for greater political space, essentially, in the lead up to the 2010 presidential elections, which would be pivotal in terms of Rwanda's development and its political development. The fact that this was all going on in Congo at a time when the international community was concerned that the Congolese government would be destabilized, the first Congolese elected government in years would be destabilized and undermined by a rebel leader who was potentially backed by Kigali, meant that Rwanda was backed into a very tight corner. An indeliberate reference to your paper. So basically what Rwanda did, and this is why I ended up using the theory of unbalancing to explain it, was to align with Congo, which was the lesser of the threats. I mean, actually the people with the greater potential to threaten the Rwandan government were the international community, because they still held purse strings. They might not be willing to use them, but it was still possible that there was leverage there. Or civil society and opposition movements within Rwanda, so the potential for an armed insurrection, which I think is a very limited possibility. So what Rwanda does is to align with the DRC in order to get the international community off its back about what's happening in Congo. If you can appease the international community about what's happening in Congo, then you can have a relatively free hand in dealing with challenges in the run-up to the 2010 elections. And basically the argument that the paper makes is that's exactly what Rwanda does. So it aligns with one potential threat, which is the Congolese government in Congo, in order to deal with the bigger threat, which is the international community, and to prevent a perfect storm of alignment. So if you have a situation where the Rwandan government is facing dissatisfaction from the international community over Congo, it's making it very, very difficult for them to continue the relationships with Rwanda in the face of what's happening in eastern Congo and this threat to the Congolese government. The Rwandan government decides to appease Congo, take the Congo issue off the table as far as the international community is concerned, and we can carry on dealing with domestic dissent in the way that we've always dealt with it. And it gave them that free hand. So it's basically the argument that the paper makes in a nutshell. I am quite happy to answer questions on that, but just in terms of my conclusions, because there might be some broader points there. So I don't think that unbalancing explains all alignment decisions. I also don't necessarily think that Rwanda is the unique case that some might argue it is, because I think countries like Uganda and Ethiopia as well have used very similar tactics and strategies in order to gain space for themselves to operate at a domestic level, particularly in the run-up to elections. And I think Uganda's operations in Somalia are another illustration of that. I think also on the balancing is useful because it makes us focus on internal factors. So even though we're talking about Rwanda's surprising decision to align with Congo, actually what we really should be looking at is the fact that the 2010 elections are coming up. So African leaders in this analysis are more interested in threats at the domestic level because that's where the real threat to their power is. The continental institutions that could potentially discipline African leaders don't. And I'm not saying they necessarily should, and I think you made a really good argument this morning about how African institutions have to be built on their own ideas, and actually if everyone ignores them because they say they're not our ideas, and that's not the way we would do things, that's not a particularly helpful method of engagement either. The focus on internal factors is useful, and also the fact that I make an argument in the paper that agency is maximised where alignment decisions chime with narratives that appeal to powerful states. So even though I'm not saying that donors hold all the power in this situation, because I think the Rwandan government is exercising quite a strong degree of agency in terms of its choices, I think if it wasn't for the fact that it was buying into a narrative about African destabilisation and destabilisation in the Congo in particular, it might not have had so much effect on its agency. So I think in terms of broader points for how do you get agency, you appeal to very broad donor narratives, you try and decide what kinds of, not just donor narratives, but narratives more generally, and decide whether African states, I'll go on to that. The next point, sorry, I'm just finished. So I've lost my point again, but okay. Yeah, so I said at the end, this basically raises the question, which is beyond the paper, which is whether examples of African state and regime agency are bounded by broader structures which they don't have the power to define, in this case, narratives and structures and discourses around African insecurity, and if they're therefore doomed only to manipulate those through the sort of bio approach of extroversion, or whether they can transcend those structures. And I'm not sure that we've really come across any examples, even across the series, where African states have been able to transcend structures, or African agents have been able to transcend structures. I think we've mainly been talking about working within them. So that's something to consider. Any questions?
Excellent. Thanks very much. Okay.